Geoscience,
genetics,
medicine,
information technology,
physics,
biotechnology,
astronomy,
ecology,
mathematics,
SciPod.
SciPod.
This is SciPod.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on SciPod, nerves of silicon? Computer-controlled cars race each other across the Mojave Desert. But would you take a taxi when there's no one to tip? Past the sunblock, astronomers ponder the curious case of the planet with three suns. And butterfly on line one. Scientists demonstrate a new way to protect your phone calls using chaos theory. Join us for these stories and more from the pages of New Scientist magazine and newscientist.com. And while you're at it, don't forget to enter our weekly quiz. You could win one of five Bose sound docks. And all you have to do is play. Now, to kick off this week's podcast, here's Jeffrey Whittle.
The German car company Volkswagen is well known for the slogan, drivers wanted. Now it turns out those drivers may not be required after all. Last month, the computer-controlled Volkswagen was the first car across the finish line in the second-ever DARPA Challenge. DARPA, the advanced research branch of the U.S. military, invited robotics and artificial intelligence experts to compete for a $2 million prize by racing cars that literally drive themselves across a 200-kilometer desert course that included boulders, tunnels, and narrow cliff-hugging tracks. New Scientist editor Greg Huang describes the winning vehicle.
It was a Volkswagen SUV that was designed by Stanford University and a team of other experts, including researchers from Volkswagen. And it basically was outfitted with six Pentium computers and an array of laser sensors and radar and camera, so it could see the road and it could analyze the obstacles in front of it.
The Stanford Volkswagen also had a distinguishing feature that may have helped it beat the competition. Its onboard computer system learned to drive by watching human drivers perform the same task.
The team members would drive the car through the desert, through terrain that was similar to the race terrain, you know, off-road and dirt roads. The computer would keep track of what the driver was doing and also what the road looked like in front of it, so that it, basically using statistics and some algorithms based on statistics, they could infer what the human was doing when it was faced with a certain kind of road in front of it.
In total, it took about 1,000 hours of driving to teach the Volkswagen enough to complete the DARPA challenge in just 6 hours and 53 minutes. Out of the 23 cars that competed, only 4 others finished the race. That may sound like a poor showing, but it's a huge improvement compared to the first DARPA challenge, which was held in March of 2004. At that event, not a single car was able to complete the course. Now the researchers are wondering what happened in 18 months that led to such a drastic change in results.
The answer is fairly complicated. It wasn't that there was a single breakthrough in artificial intelligence or sensors or computer vision. It was really a combination of factors. And basically, the teams had more time to prepare for this year's race, and that extra preparation and testing really did the trick.
The success means that there will be no further DARPA challenges and no more $2 million prizes to win, at least for now. But despite the Stanford victory, artificial intelligence experts say the race to create a reliable self-guided vehicle for commercial or military use is far from over.
This was a particular problem which a lot of teams spent tons of time to solve, but the general problem of robot navigation is far from solved. In particular, getting a computer to be able to recognize an obstacle in front of the car and tell the difference between that and something that the car could drive over is still a big problem, and you know, could come into play in everything from planetary rovers to vehicles that need to transport supplies to our troops.
Of course, there is also a significant psychological boundary to be overcome before most of us are willing to let our cars drive us around, but researchers who program the Stanford vehicle say they eventually learn to trust their Volkswagen. Perhaps a driverless future is closer than we think.
Well, the future is now, because here's a concept once thought to be highly unlikely: planets in double star systems. Here's Donna Page to explain.
Even before Luke Skywalker gazed wistfully into the double sunset from his home planet Tatooine, astronomers were looking into the question of whether or not planets could form in a double star system. For years, the conventional answer was, Not likely. Mainly because the gravitational tug-of-war between double stars would be expected to disrupt the delicate process by which a planet coalesces out of a swirling disk of dust and gas. So imagine astronomers' surprise last July when a planet was discovered orbiting one of the stars in a nearby triple star system. In this case, the planet is in a very tight orbit, circling its parent star in just under 3.5 days. That's too close for the other two stars in the system to have any effect on the planet's orbit today. But here's the problem. The planet is known as a hot Jupiter. It could only have formed much farther from its star, just as Jupiter did in our own solar system, and then migrated to its present position later on. Astronomer Steve McMillan of Drexel University explains.
For something like a Jupiter to form, the disk has to be big enough that the outer edges of the disk are far from the parent star and that ice can form. And it's basically you need to form icy materials in the disk. The problem here is that for that to occur, you would have had to be in a part of the disk that couldn't exist because of the gravitational effect of the other pair of stars.
McMillan specializes in the group dynamics of stars. Together with a colleague, he realized this unusual system could have been created by an elaborate maneuver in which the parent star and its planet traded their way into the triple star system like a swapped dance partner.
There are two ways in which that could occur. One is that the hot Jupiter formed in a very wide binary where the distance to the other star wasn't a problem as far as creating the planet was concerned. And then later, the binary system that's now part of the triple came along and basically ejected the other companion and found its way into the orbit that we see today.
Both these scenarios suggest the planet formed first and moved into its present close orbit around the parent star long before the swapping of partners began. But even though this explains how such a planet could exist, McMillan and his colleague had a lot of work to do to show the explanation is a realistic one. To do that, they assumed that the stars had all formed in a star cluster, which most stars do. They then performed a series of experiments using a computer to simulate the masses and motions of stars in a hypothetical cluster and look to see if something like a triple star system with a planet might arise.
And what we found was that the scenario that we had thought of was quite plausible in that it was quite easy for us to get it to occur in our experiments. And when we estimated the numbers, we found that there could quite easily be hundreds of such systems formed over the age of the galaxy, you know, within a few hundred light years of the sun.
But just because this explanation works for a hot Jupiter planet, that doesn't mean there are hundreds of Luke Skywalkers out there enjoying triple sunsets. In fact, if a solar system like ours had a couple of extra suns like those in the system McMillan studied, then Earth's orbit would quickly destabilize, and we would soon find ourselves swallowed by the sun or ejected into the depths of space. Did someone say, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi"?
If you're looking for a unique Christmas gift, why not choose a New Scientist annual gift subscription? Get 4 issues free when you order. Stop searching for ideas. Give the gift of ideas. Give New Scientist magazine. We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. It's easy. Just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. That's podcast@newscientist.com.
And coming up next, a chance to win the grand prize in our weekly contest. But first, it's time for this week's cover story. From the Boston Bureau of New Scientist, here's Ivan Semenik.
Back in 1972, meteorologist Edward Lorenz asked the question, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? The question refers to an effect Lorenz observed while trying to model Earth's atmosphere, namely that in a complex system, tiny effects at the beginning of a calculation can lead to very different outcomes at the end. Since then, the butterfly effect has turned up in all kinds of physical systems, mainly as a barrier to making predictions, like predicting the weather beyond a few days. But this week, there's news that a team of physicists has used the butterfly effect as a barrier to eavesdroppers trying to pick up sensitive conversations or computer data off of public phone lines. Michael Brooks is a features editor at New Scientist magazine, and in this week's cover story, he reports on this surprising application. Hi, Michael. Welcome to SciPod.
Hi, thank you.
So how could the butterfly effect possibly be of use in communications?
Well, what happens is that the butterfly effect is a part of this thing called chaos theory. And chaos is essentially something that's completely unpredictable in our terms, but has patterns within it. And if you can pull out those patterns, then you can start to use them for communications. So if you can put your message into a chaotic signal, nobody will be able to see the message because it's just buried under this noise of chaos. But under the right circumstances, you can pull out your message again. It works as a way of keeping things hidden.
That sounds like a very handy idea if it can be made to work. So what is the breakthrough that New Scientist is reporting this week?
Well, what we're reporting on is the first use of this outside of the laboratory. People had the idea of using chaos to encode messages in the mid-1980s. In fact, it was a guy at the US Naval Research Lab that first had the idea. But nobody's been able to do it or make it work outside of the lab until now. And this paper that's reported in Nature this week is actually the first demonstration of chaotic cryptography outside of the laboratory. So we think that's a pretty major leap forward now for the technology.
Can you tell me more about what this team did and how they managed to get chaos to work for them?
Yeah, the question they were trying to answer was whether the standard optical fibers that we all use for our telephone landline communications would be amenable to having chaotic codes pass through them. And so they took the optical fiber network that was set up in Greece for the Olympic Games recently and took over that for a while and started passing their chaotic signals through it and sending messages and decoding messages. And what they've done is prove that using standard technology, things that they bought off the shelf effectively, no specialized components, they were able to implement this whole chaotic cryptography system and send messages around, I think it was something like 120 kilometers of optical fiber without losing the message and without anybody being able to break into what they were communicating.
That's amazing. So if they were starting with a message like a regular cell phone conversation, for example, how did that message get embedded into a chaotic signal, and then how did that get extracted again at the other end?
Right. Well, what you need for this chaotic communication is a laser. Normally, we think of lasers as being very coherent, very together, very ordered. But actually, what happens is they feed back some of the light out of the laser. They feed it back into the laser, which drives it into overdrive, like a speaker gets driven into feedback, producing noise. This is actually a chaotic light that comes out of these lasers once they're driven like this. And so they take the chaotic light and then add in their message, rather like we add signals into a radio signal so that we can then decode them later by tuning our radio to the right frequency. And so what you need is, as well as this laser at the front end, at the other end, at the receiving end, you want to have exactly identical laser that you drive into producing feedback noise in exactly the same way. And that enables you to kind of tune in to the message and pull out the communications that you're interested in hearing.
So really, this depends on, in a sense, identical chaos. You have one laser creating a chaotic pattern at one end, and I guess the system relies on the fact that an identical laser will, and this sounds very counterintuitive, but it would actually produce the identical chaotic pattern at the other end. How difficult is that to achieve technically?
It's actually pretty difficult unless you've got the right equipment. I mean, this is one of the great securities of the system, is that you need to have an almost identical laser at both ends. So the team actually use a laser that's made from a semiconductor, and they have to use the same piece of semiconductor, and they have to be produced by the same manufacturer so that all the variables in the laser are exactly the same. They then have to take the chaotic light that comes out of the transmitting laser and put a portion of that into the receiving laser as the way of creating the feedback noise. And that is the only way in which you can recreate the exact same chaos that you've got in your transmitter in order to be able to subtract it and read the message. So you're really in a position where it's almost impossible to eavesdrop on this because you just need such exacting requirements from your equipment. But once you have those, then it's very easy. So you could plug one in at one end and the other one in at the other end and, you know, be fairly secure in your encryption.
And it all depends on getting chaos to happen the same way, or I guess getting the butterflies to flap in the same way in two different places.
Exactly. I mean, it does seem counterintuitive that you can synchronize chaos like this. But that's what happens, is the transmitting laser manages to synchronize its chaos with the chaos that's produced in the receiving laser. And so what we have is synchronized chaos between two systems that are, you know, separated by 120 kilometers apart. but producing exactly the same chaotic signal. It's quite extraordinary. It's as if you could get the butterfly to flap its wings and produce identical tornadoes in Melbourne, Australia, and in Texas.
Well, thanks, Michael, for telling us about this.
You're welcome.
Michael Brooks spoke to us from London.
Now it's time for Insight, our weekly quiz. The rules are simple. Each week we ask you one insightful question. All you have to do is provide the one-word answer, which you can usually find somewhere inside the pages of NewScientist.com or NewScientistSpace.com. Last time, we asked you, what is the phenomenon that lets astronomers see star formation 50 times better than before? And the one-word answer is cloud chime. Everyone who answered correctly was automatically entered in our grand prize draw for a Bose SoundDock digital music system. Answer every week for the 9 weeks of our quiz, and you'll have 9 times the chances of winning. We have 5 SoundDocks to give away, and one of them will go this week to our first lucky winner. And that winner is Greg Matthews from Surrey, UK. Thanks, Greg, for participating in our quiz, and to all of those who didn't win, your correct answers are still valid for the next draw in 2 weeks. So don't stop now. Here's this week's quiz. And our question this week has to do with a powerful new method that researchers are experimenting with to treat certain forms of cancer. This method involves using a modified virus that can infect and kill cancer cells while leaving normal cells alone. Our question is, what virus is on track to become the first virus approved for treating cancer? Remember, we're looking for a one-word answer. To enter, visit www.newscientist.com/podcast. Please send in your answer before noon Greenwich Mean Time on Friday, November 25th. And be sure to listen to our December 2nd podcast to find out if you are the next of our 5 lucky winners.
Planet, life, body, mind. NewScientist.com. From the infinitely large to the fleetingly fast. NewScientist.com. It's your online resource to science, nature, and technology. With daily stories about cloning, climate change, stem cells, nanotechnology, evolution. Your world runs on science. Don't let that world pass you by. Visit NewScientist.com today and check out New Scientist Space for breaking stories in human spaceflight, technology, astronomy, and more. NewScientistSpace.com.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the November 18th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, why the food you eat could change your genes for life. A new study suggests diet affects the way different genes are expressed, which could permanently alter behavior or even halt the onset of genetic diseases. Tuning into earthquakes. Why one geophysicist thinks the planet is trying to tell us something by emitting ultra-low-frequency radio waves. And a look at how scientists arrive at their biggest discoveries. Is it years of hard work or just plain luck that makes a eureka moment? Novelist and physicist Alan Lightman investigates. We'll have this and lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.